All right, it is 7:30. We're going to call the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee of the Board of Regents to order. Winner, could you please call the roll?
Chair Geddes?
Here.
Vice Chair Carter?
Present.
Regent McAdoo?
Present.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
Regent Trachok?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. Could you please, we'll move to item number one, public comment. Winter, do you have public comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have one public comment submission from Serge Balith. I would like to address the ARSA committee to express my concerns about the rigid direction of the co-requisite action plan for math is taking. I am not a member of the statewide task force, but I have been part of many of the discussions with the task force members. In the spring of 2020, I was thrilled with the direction the implementation plan was taking. We had solid directives and had built an infrastructure of possible co-requisite courses that would ensure that all students were taking college-level math courses in their first year, while also allowing the individual schools to experiment and adapt. Over the summer, all the flexibility evaporated. A common credit requirement was imposed so that all schools would be treated equally by the funding formula. Now schools no longer have the autonomy and adaptability that made this initiative so appealing. Future deviations from the specific requirements of the implementation plan are only possible if all schools come together and agree upon a change. The Common Credit Mandate values equality over equity, and I predict that it will cause many more problems than it will solve. I have not yet spoken with a math professor in NSHE who is supportive of such a rigid structure. Of course, we will do our best to serve and teach our students, but our potential is limited when the flexibility to adapt is hampered. The task force has agreed to specific co-requisite credit counts under the threat that the decision will be taken from them if they don't pick a number. This is not consistent with the way NSHE has supported shared governance in the past. It is important to me that this committee understand that my enthusiasm for this project has greatly diminished because I feel no ownership of the decisions. The whole plan is starting to feel like a top-down mandate. I am grateful for the efforts of ARSA and the Math Task Force. I'm also grateful for the policy and the push to remove standalone remedial courses. The NSHE system will be more effective for having made these changes. I just fear that we will be less effective than we could be because the implementation plan diminishes the potential for individual institutions to adapt and take ownership of their programs. Please give us back some control over our programs. Mr. Chair, that is all we have for public comment at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Winter. And just a piece of housekeeping, we're going to take item 13, the Gwynn Center, right after item number 6. Just so we don't have to go bouncing back and forth between institutions on the call. So we'll just take the UNR items in order and then go through the other institutions. Now we'll go to item number 2, the consent agenda. Do I have a motion for approval of the consent agenda?
I second, Kathy.
Motion from, was that Patrick?
Trachok.
Motion from Regent Trachok, second from Regent McAdoo. Thank you. Any questions or comments on the consent agenda? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We will now go to item number 3, the NSHE Planning Report, Academic Master Plan, Assistant Vice Chancellor Renee Davis.
Good morning, everyone. Assistant Vice Chancellor Renee Davis presenting the NSHE Planning Report and Academic Master Plan for 2021-2025. This is a full update rather than the periodic updates we've done the last few years, and it's on our usual timeline. One item of note is that we have not included any certificates. In the past, certificates have been included as an option, not a requirement. And now they're no longer going to show up in this document. And mostly that's because the certificate approval process is meant to be more nimble so that our campuses can be responsive to industry needs. So just wanted to make note of that. And if you have any comments or questions regarding the specific institutional items, then I would defer to the institutions on those questions.
Thank you. And for those who haven't seen this report before, this, we do submit this to the legislature so they know what our plans are going forward in the 2-year and 4-year cycle. And as Renee pointed out there with the certificates, we want to be more nimble. And so we're not including those in here so they can add them at any time, but we will always be updated when they are bringing those forward. So we'll know what's going forward there. Do I have a motion for acceptance of the planning report and master plan?
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Regent Perkins.
Thank you. I was just in another conference that it was very important for us to show how the legislators, how nimble we are, and that we are working with the Department of with GOED and with development. So I think those certificates might be important this time around, just to maybe as a separate document, but they definitely should be mentioned.
Thank you. That's good input. Will,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
May I respond, Ms. Perkins? So also on this agenda, we have the new and existing program review. The existing program review includes all certificates at the skills and so the less than 30 credit level and the 30 credit and above level that have been approved by AAC in the past year. So we are reporting that kind of after the fact, but it allows the institutions, as the chairman indicated, to be more nimble. But that type of information is disclosed publicly, and one source is the existing program review that is included on this agenda, just so that you're aware.
Oh, it's not for, thank you. Not for me, but just for the, like, if this report is going to the legislators, then they definitely need to know that what we're doing and that we're, you know, yeah.
And I think to Regent Perkins' comment there, we should make sure we get it out to GOED and the development authorities, LVGA and EDON and the others. Just send them those reports.
Thank you.
A motion for approval from Regent Trachok. Do I have a second?
Sure.
Regent Perkins. Any questions or comments on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Regent Carter?
Yes. So one of the things I took away from looking at this is there's a lot of like very low additional cost programs. And this may be a fantastic cycle due to our current situation to like look at a lot of those. Some of them are very, I mean, they're like a robotics program. There's like a lot of them that would be great for our state to kind of roll out that are note for very, very low additional costs. And I would just encourage our institutions to pursue those, you know, over this next couple of years as we try to weather the storm here.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 4, UNLV program proposal, MS data analytics. President Whitfield.
Yes, thank you, Regent Geddes. I'm going to have Chris Heavey, the provost and executive vice president, present that case.
Thank you, President Whitfield and Chair Geddes. We're delighted to be in front of you this morning asking for approval for our new master's program in data analytics. This is an interdisciplinary program that will utilize resources from across the campus to offer this cutting-edge degree, which is in very high demand, both from students and with this skill set from employers. We think this program will be very popular as soon as it launches. The program does ask for a small differential fee just for 4 of the courses that will be new in the program of $300 per credit. For those 4 particular courses, the students would just take 1 of those courses in any given semester. So their differential cost would just be $300 per semester above the regular tuition cost for the program. And that additional $1,200 will make the total cost of this program far below any competitor that we've been able to identify. So we think this will be a very popular program and will serve the students very well. Happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Chair, I have a question. Now, Chris, what is the What would be the cost to the university for starting up this program?
Well, the program will rely predominantly on existing resources, and so we think the major incremental cost will be in the computer resources and software that will be required to provide the appropriate training for the students. And so we do think this program will essentially be subsidized by the institution. If you look at the budget that's available in the main board agenda this afternoon for the differential fee proposal, it shows that we'll only bring in about $27,000 per semester from differential fees for this program, and we have committed to using 15% of that revenue to offer scholarships to high-need students. So essentially, we bring in about $23,000 of additional revenue per semester, and we expect the cost of the program to be about $150,000 per semester. And so we'll use existing revenue streams to basically allow us to be able to offer this program.
Will we start this program now, or will we wait until the we get through the current budget crisis that we're experiencing now and expect to experience in the this session?
We do anticipate launching the program for fall 2021, and we think we do have sufficient personnel on board to offer all of these courses. And so that's the main, you know, cost of offering any of the programs is the faculty. And because it's interdisciplinary, drawing so broadly from across the university, we think we'll be able to staff all of those courses with existing faculty.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move to approve.
I have a motion for approval. Do I have a second?
Second.
Regent McAdoo. And just to clarify, we're only approving the program. The differential fee will be part of the fee on the main agenda. All we're doing is approving the program in this motion.
Thank you.
So any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Regent Carter.
So Nevada State College, we just approved their interdisciplinary data science degree, and I think that also starts in 21. Does that have a natural build to this master's program? Or we looked at that kind of?
Yes, absolutely. Those programs will fit well together. This program is designed to take in students from a wide array of undergraduate degrees, but students coming out of the Nevada State College bachelor's program would be ideally suited for this program.
Any other questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number five, UNLV program proposal, PhD Psychological and Brain Sciences. President Whitfield.
And again, I will ask Provost TV to present this case.
Thank you, Chair Geddes and President Whitfield and members of the board. This is a situation in which we've had a long-standing doctoral program in psychology that's been very successful. It started in 1999. I was actually one of the beginning graduate coordinators for that program. And you may recall that at the last board meeting, we came before you to change the name of that program to be the PhD program in clinical psychology, because essentially the program has always existed with two tracks, one in clinical psychology and one in what will now be called psychological and brain sciences. And so what we're doing here is moving the concentration that existed under the umbrella of the PhD program in psychology to be its own standalone program. And so this will not involve any new resources, any new courses. It's essentially just creating clearer differentiation between two concentrations that have existed now for over 20 years in a very successful doctoral program, and more truth in advertising for the students who enter the program and then graduate out of it that will be more descriptive of the training that they've received within the program. Happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Regent Trachuk.
Chris, I have the same two questions on this program that I had on the previous one. What is the cost and when do you anticipate starting in light of the budget constraints we're facing?
Thank you for that question, Regent Trachak. The incremental cost of this proposal will be essentially zero because this is an existing program that will not require any new courses or any new faculty, just name changes on the website, et cetera. And we do anticipate this name change going into effect, I think, for the fall of 2021, students who are entering. And students who are in the current PhD in psychology program may choose to transfer over to this new program so that it might be more descriptive as they graduate out of the program of the training that they received. But no additional costs, so we'll be able to bear those costs with the current personnel we have in place.
Thank you. Chair, I move to approve this item.
I have a motion from Regent Trachak. Do I have a second?
I second. Regent McAdoo.
Second from Regent McAdoo. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number six, UNR program proposal, PhD Natural Resources and Environmental Science. President Sandoval.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would like to refer this matter to Provost Carmen for presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, President Sandoval. Yes, thank you, President Sandoval, and thank you, Chair Geddes, excuse me, I haven't cleared my throat yet this morning, I guess, for the opportunity to present this program. We are proposing a PhD program in natural resources and environmental studies, which we abbreviate as NRES. The NRES department is really one of our most productive departments at the university in terms of grant activity and scholarly productivity. We have an amazing young faculty in this program. They participate in the Ecology, Evolution, and Conservation Biology PhD program, which is a vibrant program at our university. But they've also identified a need for a more applied PhD program that is specific to their discipline. They have a master's degree program in RES, and this PhD program would complement that program and would also serve to serve as a pipeline for students feeding into the program. So natural resource management and environmental science are fundamental to the production of food, fuel, fiber, as well as air and water quality and sustainability of natural ecosystems. This program will address the need for data-driven approaches and applications to address issues impacting the management of natural resources. It will have an applied focus that connects students to stakeholders, management, and policy decision makers. It will be, we can describe it as a discipline that will be involving translational research. That is, these students will be well educated in basic fundamental principles in environmental science and ecology, and also be trained to how to translate that knowledge into applications that serve the environment and the state and the nation well. This is an area where there's been significant growth in demand for experts in environment, conservation and wildlife organizations. If you've seen the report, there's been a very rapid growth in demand for folks with expertise in this area. There are government agencies and private consulting firms that are looking for experts with doctoral degrees in environmental sciences, and this will help serve that need as well. I know that you're well aware, and members of the board are well aware, that Nevada has the largest amount of federal land in the nation. These graduates of these programs will help, will go into various agencies such as the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, United States Geological Service, et cetera, as well as private consulting companies. Finally, I'll comment that this doctoral program will contribute to our overall mission of moving up in the ranks as an R1 university. Doctoral graduates are a key component of the metrics associated with R1 designation, and this is part of our overall strategic growth as an R1 university. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. The same questions that I had for Chris, what are the costs and when do you anticipate starting the program?
Thank you, Regent Trachak. No additional costs. The classes will be taught with existing faculty, and it will just complement programs that we already have. So no additional costs required to launch this program. We're actually hoping to start this, launch this program as quickly in this next semester, or in spring semester of 21. We have master students in the NRES department that will naturally feed into this program, and so we think we're ready to go immediately with the program.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move for approval.
I have a motion from Regent McAdoo, a second from Regent Trachok. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We've now got item number 13, UNR Organizational Unit Proposal, Gwynn Center. President Sandoval.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm very excited and proud to make this presentation with regard to the Gwynn Center. The Gwynn Center leadership approached University of Nevada, Reno leadership early in 2020 to discuss the possibility of a formal affiliation. Following a series of discussions, which included me, former President Johnson, as well as Provost Carmen, and former Chancellor Riley and current Chancellor Rose, we concluded that both the university and the Gwynn Center would benefit from a formal affiliation. The affiliation will build upon our previous collaborations with the Gwynn Center. University faculty and students will provide expertise on a broad range of public policy issues that are critical to the state of Nevada, and Gwynn Center research will provide research and learning opportunities for faculties and students. The Gwynn Center will have space allocated in Kane Hall on campus here at UNR. The Gwynn Center has indicated that they will need space for 2 to 3 persons, although initially, absent COVID, there will be one permanent staff and one intern. A third person will be traveling from Southern Nevada to Reno on a regular basis. Two to three years down the road, there could be up to 4 persons. I see on the screen that we have Dr. Nancy Bruin, who's with us, as well as Mr. Phil Satry, and the provost, as well as myself, are happy to answer any questions. But as I said, we're very, very excited, proud about the prospect of this affiliation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Regent Trachok.
Yes, thank you. President Sandoval and Phil and Nancy, glad to have you both here. Now, the question I have is, in reading through all of the materials, it looks to me that there will be no costs that will be incurred by the university, that the university will be making the space available to Gwynn Center employees in addition to having the formal affiliation with the two. Both the university and the center. Is my reading and understanding of the materials correct?
Mr. Chairman, to you and through you to Regent Trachok, you are correct, Regent Trachok. The contribution of the university is the in-kind contribution of the space. The Gwynn Center will be providing the resources for everything else.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a great move for both the Gwynn Center and for the university, and I would move to approve the agenda item.
Second.
Motion for approval. I have a second from Regent Perkins. Any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Regent Carter.
I just want to say I've been to some Gwynn Center events. I love reading the report. I think it's fantastic that they've found a home with UNR. They do some great research, and the final results are not, you know, planted or crazy. It's just reporting good data. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Nancy or Phil, would you like to add anything? Oh, Regent McAdoo.
Oh, I just wanted to comment. I also have a long history of working with Nancy Bruin and the Gwynn Center, and would really just ditto what Regent Carter said about their research and the information that they put out. That's so helpful. So I will be supporting the motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Nancy or Phil, did you want to say anything? Or
Chair Geddes, this is Phil Satry. I just have had a long history with the Gwynn Center, going back to its formation, working with President Joe Crowley and a number of others to develop a bipartisan research center. We were very fortunate very early on to identify Nancy Bruin as our first executive director, and she has really built that Gwen Center's reputation, and I think in the work product that has been generated by it. We are thrilled for the opportunity to be affiliated with the University of Nevada, Reno. We think it's going to make the Gwen Center even stronger and more impactful. We also believe that it's good for the university, for students that want to intern there and other activities. So we're very honored to be considered for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Hearing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Congratulations. We will go to item number 7, College of Southern Nevada Program Proposal, BAS and Culinary Arts. President Zaragoza.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and guests. Dr. Margo Martin here to present on items 7, 8, 9, and 10. Thank you.
Hi, good morning to everyone. Chair Geddes, Regents, Dr. Z, thank you for this opportunity. As you see from the agenda, CSN is proposing 3 different BAS degrees in the hospitality arena. The first of these is our BAS in Culinary Arts. The focus of this degree is to create a career ladder for management level for students that are coming out of our culinary arts and pastry arts programs. What this program will do is it will promote an understanding of management and skill development for the operational side of the culinary industry, truly preparing students for running a state-of-the-art culinary kitchen. Students who complete this degree will have the skills to essentially lead a world-class kitchen from daily operations to supervision of food production, menu and recipe development, inventory planning and oversight, and even personnel management. CSN's 2+2 opportunities provide open access to all of the students who are interested in pursuing a degree in the culinary arts. And as I mentioned, this BAS is going to provide that management career ladder for our students that are coming out of our 2-year culinary and pastry arts programs. So while you might be questioning why now, as the pandemic has significantly changed the way that we dine out in this current environment, we have received significant industry support and requests for this level of training. In fact, students who enroll will begin this program, if approved, in the fall of 21 and are anticipated to complete in spring of 2023. We're anticipating that the industry will be past the recovery mode at that point, and frankly, our students will be at the forefront of the new ways of safely delivering a dining experience post-pandemic. Happy to answer any questions.
Margo, you're going to get the same questions from Regent Trachok as the previous ones on this and the next item, so if you could address that.
You bet. So truly the current resources that we have in terms of human resources with faculty will cover the direction we're headed with this. As I mentioned, we are launching hopefully in 2021. And that's really going to be an ideal trajectory for students to be ready to enter that workforce as the industry begins to come back.
Thank you. Chair, I have one more question. Mm-hmm. Could you please explain why it's more appropriate to be offering this bachelor's degree at the community college as opposed to the state college or the university?
I don't know that it's necessarily more appropriate other than right now there isn't any other program in our system that's being offered that delivers this applied education in terms of moving folks that already have that 2-year degree. It gives that opportunity it's very specific to advanced culinary skills as well as combining that with the management piece of really running a kitchen. And from the folks that we are working with in industry, they're really looking for that hands-on, practical culinary kitchen management experience. And so what better place to offer that level of experience in our state-of-the-art kitchens. We're actually nationally renowned in terms of our programs in the culinary and hospitality fields. And really what makes us different is the applied nature of the work.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Chair, I move for approval.
Thank you. I have a motion from Regent Trachok, a second from Regent Perkins.
Sure.
Any questions or comments?
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Regent Perkins.
You said industry has requested. Can you name drop who in the industry and or more specifically?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we've been in direct contact with MGM, which is one of the largest employers in that regard, in addition to the folks at Resorts World. And I actually have our department chair, Joe Gormley, who used to own his own restaurant and is now chairing our entire department. We actually have a pretty deep bench at CSN with our full-time and adjunct faculty. In terms of the folks that are actually teaching our students are the folks that are actually working in the field. They are the folks that are actually on the strip, working in the hotels, working in these entertainment venues, who are actually providing the instruction to our students. Joe's on the line if you'd like more name dropping.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 8, CSN program proposal, BAS food service operations. Margo.
So again, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I didn't mean to preempt. Thank you again, Chair Geddes and Regents. So this second BAS degree in the hospitality arena is in our food service operations. And so this degree provides a career ladder for students who complete two-year degrees in food and beverage management, as well as in culinary arts. The focus of this degree is supervision and management. It's the business side of the operations, as well as customer service and preparing students for jobs not only in hospitality, but anywhere food service is happening. Could be in a healthcare facilities, could be in a school district, could be preparing students to open up a franchise. CSN students, another point I wanna make, and not only for this degree, but the other two, is that CSN students primarily are local students. We do have some students that come from afar to participate in our recognized culinary and hospitality programming, but for the most part, our students are local, and they're going to remain local. And so this degree is going to contribute significantly to preparing the future food service workforce in Southern Nevada. As I mentioned before, it's an applied degree. And to respond to those prior questions, we currently have the human resources in place to be able to deliver this programming. And again, the folks that are teaching our students are already engaged in our world-class hospitality industry in Las Vegas.
Thank you. Regent Trachok?
I would move for approval.
I have a motion.
Second.
Have a second. Second from Regent Perkins. Any other questions or comments on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 9, CSN program proposal, BAS tourism, convention, and event planning. Margo.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much again. Third and final proposal for today. This degree, once again, provides a 2+2 opportunity for students who are engaged in CSN's current tourism, convention, and event planning programming, as well as those individuals who already have a degree and are seeking further development in a world-class tourism and convention city, Las Vegas. The opportunity to work directly with industry experts who serve as full-time and adjunct faculty is beyond compare. While this pandemic has certainly had a negative impact on this industry during the past 9 months, we are already seeing a resurgence in conventions and conferences, albeit virtual. So the purpose of this BAS degree, or the launch of this BAS degree, is going to be fall of 21, and our graduating students will come out in spring of 23. So again, the timeline trajectory is really ideal. And what this is going to do is it's going to assure that the students who are graduating are going to be the next generation of the workforce who will be well prepared to respond to the new normal of tourism, convention, and event planning in the tourism capital of the world. Same human resources, same budget impact.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval?
So moved.
Motion from Regent Krajcak, second from Regent McAdoo.
Regent McAdoo.
Questions or comments?
Just a comment, if I may.
Yes, Regent Perkins.
I love this because it gives an example of what the community colleges are supposed to be doing, and CSN is doing that very well. And it's one of my bragging points about how nimble CSN is responding and discussing and collaborating with industry. So you have my vote.
Any other questions or comments?
Chair Gaines, would you indulge me?
Yes.
I would like to congratulate the faculty, the department chair, and the dean over the hospitality departments. This has really been a labor of love for them, and this is really going to have a tremendous ripple effect in this community once these programs are launched. Thank you for letting me share that.
Thank you, and I would just encourage all of them, as Regent Carter has previously pointed out, to make sure and collaborate and work with UNLV and their hospitality program and make sure that they're gaining from their experience as well as we develop these.
Thank you.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 10, new and existing program review. Vice Chancellor Abbott.
I will actually defer to our Director of Public Policy, Tarina Casaretto, who will present this.
Tarina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tarina Casaretto for the record. Today I'm presenting the new and existing program review. There are four parts to this agenda item. There's the new program report, the existing program report, and then there will be two presentations, one from UNR and the other one from TMCC, as they provide an overview of essentially how they conduct their existing program reviews. And the first report is the new program review. This meets the reporting requirement for board policy in which new programs at the university, state, and community colleges shall be reviewed following the first, third, and fifth year of existence. Generally, the review compares full-time equivalent headcount and expenditures that were projected in the original program proposal.
Teresa, I'm sorry, just one second. If you're not speaking, if you could please mute your microphones. We're getting some weird feedback here. Sorry, go ahead, Teresa.
That's okay. In the past, the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee requested that institutions provide a detailed summary of programs whose actual enrollment figures were low relative to the projected enrollment levels. Mr. Chair, should you have any questions on the programs reviewed in this report, I will defer to the respective institutions to answer those.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Rena, for calling you Teresa. My apologies.
That's all right.
Coffee's still coming in. I had one for TMCC on the paramedic program.
Okay.
They were anticipating 138, and they ended up with 8. And it just seems... I'm just curious why. That seems like that would be a very popular program. If someone from TMCC could respond to that.
Marie, I believe that you're still muted.
Marie, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm doing a phone and video thing to... My internet's been messing up. Okay, Marie Mergelow, Vice President of Academic Affairs, TMCC. Yes, when the program was launched, there was an issue when we turned in the associate degree. The state of Nevada doesn't require the associate degree, and the appeal wasn't there for the students. Now that we're not having that degree, we're using just a certificate, we're getting much more interest in it. So I think it was just kind of a misstep there with the alignment of the degree with the demand, but I believe we've rectified that.
Thank you. And then for UNR, the graphic design, it was anticipating 49 and we have two. Provost Carmen? Or
Regent Geddes, thank you. I'll step in there. This is and will be a very popular program. It was just a bit slow in getting staffed up in terms of our faculty and getting the program launched. So we actually have very high demand that we anticipate in the future. So I think the next report you'll see a significant change there.
Thank you. Any other regents with questions or comments on the report?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Regent Carter.
I do have a comment. So I caught the same thing for paramedics, and what it just made me think of is we just approved WNC's, you know, paramedics program, and I think, you know, maybe we need to come up with a way to, you know, if we've just rolled out a program at one institution, wait until we have the first year metrics to then maybe approve the second program for a school that's really close in proximity, because seemingly if there was a need, like there's tons of capacity at TMCC for some of those folks, and maybe there is a need, maybe there isn't a need. I don't know, but looking from this, it doesn't appear like it's growing very fast.
Thank you. We need a motion to accept this report, Crystal? Yes. Do I have a motion to accept the new program review report?
Oh, I apologize, Mr. Chairman. That's incorrect. These are for informational. Apologies.
Yep, I see that now. Thank you. Karina, continue.
Okay. So next I present the existing program review. This report meets board policy in that a review of existing academic programs shall be conducted by the university's state and community colleges on at least a 10-year cycle. This ensures academic quality and helps determine if the need, student demand, and available resources support the program continuation. There are two summary tables at the beginning of this report. The first table is a summary of all the eliminated programs in the last academic year. And the second table is a summary of all programs reviewed in the last academic year. And then the institutions then submitted reports for each of the programs they reviewed. The Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee asked institutions this year to report on the 150% completion rate for each program reviewed, and that data is included under each program report. Once again, Mr. Chair, should you have any questions on the programs contained in the full report, I would defer to the respective institutions.
Thank you, Tarina. And I think Regent Carter would very much like to dive deep into this report on the Budget Reduction Committee and see those programs that may not be performing as they should going forward. And I think that'd be a helpful tool for that committee. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, next, Karina.
Okay. Well, next, based on established board policy, we will have two presentations. The first presentation will be from UNR Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, David Shintani. And then the second presentation will be from TMCC Vice President for Academic Affairs, Marie Mergolo. Each will provide an overview of essentially how they conduct their existing program reviews. And then each will also present on at least one program reviewed this year from their institutions. Thank you, and I will hand this over to back to you, Mr. Chair, and then to David Shintani.
Thank you. David, please proceed.
Yeah, good morning. My name is David Shintani. I'm the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm here to give an overview of UNR's process and procedures related to academic program review and assessment. Next slide, please. shall get my next slide. All of the activities that I will discuss today are built around our current strategic plan's core theme of establishing excellence in learning, discovery, and engagement. As we enter the last year of our current strategic planning period, we are proud of our achievements and are excited to begin the process of developing a new strategic plan as President Sandoval takes the university into a new phase of our development. Regarding regional accreditation, NWCCU came to campus in the spring of 2019 to conduct our mid-cycle review, and we feel that the review went very well and provided us with constructive recommendations that will guide us guide our thinking as we prepare our full accreditation report in 2023. Regarding our next slide, please. Regarding our academic program review process, all undergraduate and graduate degree programs undergo a thorough review on a 7-year cycle. Because many of our degree programs are also reviewed by professional accrediting organizations, whenever possible, we combine the accreditation and program reviews to prevent duplications of efforts. Next slide, please. As a general set of guidelines, program reviews are department-centered, such that all academic programs offered by a given department are simultaneously evaluated. The departments are encouraged to make the review an open and collaborative process and include the input from faculty, staff, and students. Furthermore, program self-studies are designed that they should address recommendations made from the previous program review and comment on the progress made since. All our program reviews require the participation of a team of unbiased experts, expert external evaluators. Next slide, please. The process begins in August, at which time the department begins preparing the self-study document. At the end of November, the self-study is sent to the external reviewers for evaluation. Then, in around February or March, the external reviewers come to campus for a 2-day site visits. The reviewers then return home and have an approximately 1 month to generate the report. Upon receipt of the reviewer's report, the program review process culminates in a meeting between the department chair, the college dean, and the provost. In this meeting, we discuss the reviewer's report, reviewer's recommendations. We also have implemented a 3-year reporting process to assess the program's progress towards addressing their action plans in the midterm. Next slide, please. To ensure that the reviews are data-driven and provide a holistic perspective of each program, we have developed a template to guide the departments in their preparation of the self-study document. We believe that this template captures the required metrics and information needed to provide the external reviewers with a good understanding of the departments and the programs under review. Next slide, please. So now I'd like to highlight a recent program review. Specifically, in 2019, the Accrediting Council on Education, Journalism, and Mass Communications conducted an accreditation review of the Reynolds School of Journalism's undergraduate degree programs. In the next few slides, I'd like to summarize the findings of these reviews. Next slide, please. The reviewers commented on the school's innovative and relevant curriculum. The Reynolds School of Journalism offers Bachelor's of Arts degrees in journalism with emphases in news, broadcasting, and documentary, public relations and advertising, media studies, Spanish language media, and visual communications. The reviewers applauded the school's prioritization of experiential learning opportunities for its students, in which includes several innovative and unique programs, including Alpha Design, which is a student-run design studio, the Hitchcock Project, a new program that focuses on science communications through media, and Noticiero Movil, a student-run multimedia news outlet providing Spanish and English language content to the Latinx community. Next slide, please. The reviewers always also commented on the school's commitment to diversity and equity and inclusion. This is reflective in the current very diverse student body, where approximately 30% of the journalism students are individuals of color and 66% are female. Next slide, please. The department has recognized the changing demographics of students over the past few years and has made deliberate efforts to help make faculty and staff hires that reflect the diversity of its student body. As we can see, the previous program review, since the previous program review in 2013, the Reynolds School has made significant strides in increasing representation of women and individuals of color in both their faculty and staff. Next slide, please. Regarding enrollment trends, since 2014, the school has observed slight decreases in student enrollment. However, the reviewers commented that similar trends have been observed nationally in other schools of journalism, and the Reynolds School's decreases are significantly less than many of those observed at other universities. We believe that the school's innovative and responsive approach to program development will reverse these negative trends in the near future. But on the positive side, the school has seen impressive increases in graduation rates, also decreases in time to degree, and excellent student retention. So we feel like the school is on a strong footing to be successful. Next slide, please. The overall impressions of the accrediting team was very positive. They commented on the school's strong leadership, its innovative curriculum, its commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and its commitment to teaching. It also was impressed by its strong stakeholder relations and the number of national recognitions and awards that have been given to the department and to its faculty. Next slide, please. The reviewers did cite a small number of concerns, specifically the reliance on endowments to support faculty and staff, the need for more internship opportunities, and the need to better align classroom curriculum with the practical labs. However, they felt that these issues can be addressed, and the overall program was rated as excellent, and in the end was recommended for accreditation. Next slide, please. So going forward, the department has committed to address the reviewers' concerns through an action plan described in the MOU with the provost office. Specifically, they will work with the university to ensure the fiscal sustainability and endowment funded positions. They will develop alternative experiential learning opportunities to ensure students meet the school's professional development expectations. And third, they will provide a curricular alignment between LOAs or TA-taught labs with faculty-taught lecture courses. Next slide, please. So that's the overall review of the journalism program review. I'd like to also note that regarding upcoming review and assessment priorities, we have three major initiatives going on this year. First, we are currently in the process of inducting the first five-year review of our new general education curriculum. We are also, as mentioned previously, our current strategic plan is expiring this year, and we are in the initial stages of developing the new strategic plan. And finally, we are launching a new annual academic program assessment process and reporting structure that will focus on assessing foundational learning objectives related to effective communication, quantitative reasoning, and critical thinking for all our academic programs. Next slide, please. So that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions related to our program review and assessment processes. Also, Dean Alan Stravinsky is also here to answer any questions you may have related to the Reynolds School of Journalism and the school's accreditation review. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the regents? Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dean. We will now, Tarina, who's next?
CC Marie Mergolo will be next, and she should have slides also.
Great. Thank you. The floor is yours, Marie.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Geddes and Regents, and thank you so much for the opportunity to present Truckee Meadows Community College's PUR process. Marie Mergolo, Vice President of Academic Affairs, TMCC, for the record. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Can you hear me? Okay, thanks. Okay, first, before we begin, I do want to acknowledge Melissa Dedman, who's our Associate Dean of Assessment and Planning. She has done so much work over the years to improve this process and make it incredibly meaningful for faculty who have really embraced it. So I just want to start by thanking her for her work on the whole process. What we do is conduct a systematic review to ensure that we have a method for continual improvement. Every program goes up for review every 5 years. We look for opportunities to improve that we look internally as well as externally by an external environmental scanning. The recommendations that are made tie in and drive our resource allocation process so that we know that, you know, the programs are supporting the strategic plan and the needs and to grow and improve the program are tied in to our resource allocation. So it helps us prioritize our budget. Next slide, please. When we look at the process, in fall, the self-study group, which is a group of faculty representative of all the areas that are covered in that program, get together and they produce the report. By spring, we have three levels of review, academic standards and assessment committee, the dean, and the vice president. They go on to give a detailed review of every aspect of the report. Then there's meetings that are done if there's disagreements or, you know, disalignments on the recommendations. Meetings are held between the parties and the committee so that agreement is reached. Once we have alignment of the recommendation, this drives that budgeting aspect of it. So when our resource allocation process takes place, and budget requests are made, they are tied directly into the process of improvement for the program. And then something else that we do is we have annual progress reports, APRs, and every one of the goals set in here are reviewed on an annual basis so that we know they're moving in the right trajectory, and if they have to be modified, modifications could be made at that time. But that annual review is very, very useful. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, the Academic Standards and Assessment Committee, they review this, they drive it. They are a standing committee for our Faculty Senate, and they have representatives from all across all of the divisions. What's really helpful is that every one of these PUR committees in the departments or divisions have an ASA member who is their captain or champion who works with them to make sure that they are moving in a timely manner, they have the information they need, and that the report is going to meet the standards by the end of it. So they have someone who works with them. And then they're able to attend the discussions on the recommendations with the dean, VP, or in the committee. So that really helps keep that continuity throughout. Next slide, please. Thank you. When we look at the different areas of the report, we look at first how it supports our overall mission as an institution and the division's the division's goals and objectives as well, that the program objectives all are a foundational support for that. And then we do external scanning to look at factors that could be expected to impact the future of the program. Fairly standard looking at the curriculum program learning outcomes, and this is where we go back and we look at what happened in the last PUR, each of the annual progress reports, and where it is now that it's reached its five-year point and the new review is going to be done. The demographics are really important to understand who we're serving and how they're doing, basically. So that's all the information that our institutional research department supplies us with. When we look at the resources and strategic planning, we look at the, you know, what we need to achieve to reach that next level, to have that continual improvement, and then the resources it will take to support that. And that works in with the strategic plan as well and helps us to better articulate and support our request for resources. Okay, next slide, please. This just goes over some of the data, and we're going to look at some of these on the plan we're going to cite here. Just looking at the demographic information, the enrollment information, and faculty workload. We won't look at all of these. We'll just look at a few of those. But it's hard data that the more wonderful IR department keeps up to date for us on an ongoing basis. Next slide, please. Hey, we're going to take a look at our business studies program unit review that was done in this last year. It has quite a number of degrees and certificates under it, and I have to say that the department was amazing. Every single area that is covered in here had at least one, but sometimes multiple faculty members who were doing the deep dive into this. And it was actually a wonderful team building exercise for them as well. They really enjoyed collaborating on this. And now we'll take a look at some of the data involved in this. Next slide, please. Okay, these are the degrees and certificates over the period of time that the review looked at that were conferred to our students. And this degree, the associate degree in business, other than our general associate degrees, is the highest degree conferring program in the college. Next slide, please. Okay, if we look at the overall pass rate here, it's at our business department, it's 79%, but I do just want to make note that it would be even higher if you take out real estate. Real estate is a skill certificate that is used just for people who are getting their license in real estate. So they are held to a 75% for passing because the state exam requires 75% for passing. So it's a much higher pass rate than most of the other classes require. But it's still, excellent pass rate overall, even with them included. If you could move to the next slide, please. If we look at the retention, that's something else that has had, a very good trajectory. It's hit a high of 81% in the numbers here, the last data that we had represented, which was 2018, and that's a 9% increase between the fall of 2009 and 2018. They've put a lot of programs in place. I actually was the dean back in the early days of this, and I started an orientation program that was just for business students, and we had people from industry come in, and they would present on their career path, how they got there, what they do on a daily basis, and what recommendations they would give for people they're looking to hire. There were helpful workshops on, writing a research paper, doing research in library sources, even down to financial aid and financial literacy to help students be successful. And it was a way for students to meet each other so they could form these supportive groups as they work through their degree. The dean, the current dean, emails every single student in that program to offer them encouragement and support. Faculty reach out, offer to mentor students as they work through the program. And, not all of them, but a number of students do take them up on that. So there have been a lot of positive moves that have helped increase this retention rate. Next slide, please. One of the things that our programs have all been doing is curriculum mapping. This shows two learning outcomes. Some of them have obviously more than that. Some have four. And not every class will have all of the learning outcomes covered. This sample just happens to do so. But it really helps. I mean, if you put a grid together with all the classes in a degree and all of the program learning outcomes that are supposed to be achieved, and you put X's on all of those, when you superimpose those, every single space in that grid should be filled. And then we know that we are really delivering to our students what we are promising and telling them we will deliver. So the curriculum mapping has been very, very useful. That's just an example of what they've done there. Next slide, please. And here we just want to show that, you know, our 63% of the degree earners transfer, and of those, 86% transfer to UNR. You're welcome. They love your program. They love going through ours. We work very, very closely and collaboratively with UNR to ensure that there is a seamless transfer and perfect articulation, and our students walk in as full-standing juniors. And the data that we see may actually do marginally better than the students that started in their freshman year, which is kind of the standard across the U.S. And so we are mirroring that here. But we are really delighted and pleased that so many of our students do transfer on and continue their educational path at UNR. Next slide, please. Okay, when we took a look at the findings, I'm giving you a sample of some of the strengths and weaknesses that were shown. One is that articulation agreement that we talked about. And as I said, I believe, Crystal, the last review that your office did, we are at 100% there. So we're very, very pleased with that. As I mentioned, it is the business AA is the largest degree outside of the general AA or AS transfer degrees, as far as transfer degrees go. One of the things that's really very helpful as in a business degree, because a lot of our students at the community college are working, is that it can be completed in person or online. Every single class is offered in both modalities. One of the things we pride ourselves on is our faculty. Our faculty all have excellent real world experience. Comes from, you know, the accounting ones come from excellent accounting firms, some of the big six accounting firms. Our logistics instructor worked for Boeing and ran their logistics area in Seattle. So we have some really well-qualified faculty member, and the students love that balance between the academic and the real world that they get to experience in the classroom. I won't go through and read all these to you. As I mentioned, the GO Day, which is the support and success program that we do at the beginning of the year for all of the business students. And we do make sure that the learning outcomes, the program learning outcomes, are very much aligned well with the course learning outcomes. Next slide, please. Take a look at some of the weaknesses that were identified. Is, although many of the disciplines in this area, such as marketing and management, accounting, do have full-time dedicated faculty, the actual business area does not, and it's covered by faculty in the other areas and LOAs, and we do feel that it'll be stronger focus on this if we do get a full-time faculty, dedicated faculty member. And the college was in full support of that because the one that we had retired a few years ago, and it was a position, you know, we were holding for cost savings, and then we were actually in the process of advertising for the position when, you know, the world happened, 2020 happened. And so that's been, you know, sidelined once again. When we look at the bottom thing, the course scheduling, that they said it could have been done more strategically. I'm very proud to say that all of the deans have been charged and have completed working with the department chairs and the faculty members to create a zero-based schedule, rather than rolling everything over, really looking at student need and demand and degree path, and created this so that they were able to develop a very tight zero-based budget. And that work has just been completed and will go into effect in the next academic year. So we're pleased with that and think that helped overcome one of these weaknesses. When we go to the next slide, please, we'll just take a look at, there were many goals set forth. I think that, you know, one of them that we keep hearing about is reflected in goal 4, where, you know, we need to integrate more soft skills into the curriculum. And that's something that the faculty are working very, you know, very closely on. And to continually maintain the quality of course and work through continual improvement. We want to work on that successful completion of students. I mean, that's if our students, their goal is to get that degree, we want to help them do that. We've actually increased, you know, as we said, increased our retention rate. We've also been focusing on our part-time students, which are the students that we find, if we're, you know, going to lose students, it will be those part-time students. And we're getting, we're starting to see success in that realm as well. Next slide, please. There's just more goals. They actually had 11 goals, and the last one was world peace, but I decided to leave that one off of here, but they felt like, you know, they wanted to achieve so much. So you could take a look at these. I won't read them to you. I know we're running out of time. So the last slide, please. Basically, we could see that we have the self-reflection and analysis. We look at the 5-year strategic plan, make sure that this builds on that. We go through the recommendations, make sure that, you know, the PR committee, the ASA committee, the dean, and the BPAA all come to agreement on those recommendations, because once again, as I said, that's going to drive our resource request. And then we have, as I said, our annual review of this that helps close the loop up until the next 5-year review starts. So kind of in a nutshell, that's our process and that's our example. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marie. Are there any questions or comments from the regents?
Mr. Chair?
Regent Carter.
I just want to thank TMCC for working with UNR. I think on page 12 there, would become a great feeder for UNR. But I guess a question or comment or something for our two universities and our state college to look at. We're losing 27 folks to Western Governors University. So maybe that means that we need to have an online, you know, business degree or something like that that corresponds to our community colleges, so we don't lose those folks in there. But just a couple notes from there. Thanks.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Any other questions or comments? Brina, is that it?
Yes, that concludes the presentations for this agenda item. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We will now go to item number 11, co-requisite action plan, part 2. Vice Chancellor.
Mr. Chair.
Oh. Who was it?
That's Regent Carter.
Oh, Regent Carter, go ahead.
Just real quick, I had forgotten to read my disclosure on items 4 and 5 for UNLV. And I'd just kind of like to add that to the record. Do you want to do that now or if you want to do it later?
All right, go ahead and do it now.
This applies to both items 4 and 5, and I'm not abstaining from either, but I just want to have it on the record. I was a previous student in the gaming innovation course at UNLV, where I developed a casino game. That game is marketed and sold. I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course are required to sign. I'll receive no remuneration from UNLV. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A, as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics, as this item does not affect my interest. I did vote in those items.
And as you said, that applied to item 4 and 5, the new programs at UNLV, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Okay, Vice Chancellor Abba.
Mr. Chairman, this kind of concludes the bulk of our work on co-rec, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to James, who will present, as we indicated in September, the second part of our co-requisite implementation plan. James?
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba and Chair Geddes, and thank you, Board of Regents and ARSA Committee, for entertaining this presentation today. Before I get started with the bulk of the presentation, I want to pay acknowledgement and a big thank you once again to our INSHE co-requisite implementation task force and the members there within. As you know, our task force is made up of several representatives from each of our 7 teaching institutions, and they have been working diligently over the last 13 months to bring forward what we see today as part 2 of 2 of our implementation action plan in line with the board policy and in ready for fall 2021 implementation with your support today. Next slide, please. So our plan for today is to go over the nuances of part two. And by the way, the entire implementation action plan part two is noted in the reference materials with the agenda along with this PowerPoint. So we'll go through all four of those major elements of part two together. And then I want to provide an update related to the Gateway Math Pathways for Business and Health Science programs, particularly as it relates to the request from the ARSA committee during our September conversation. And I also want to provide an update on where we are in our work with the fiscal and human resource analysis as it relates to implementation, full-scale implementation for fall 2021. Next slide, please. So as you may recall, at the end of part one of our action plan that you approved in September, we noted what was coming to you in part two. And these are the four major elements of the part two action plan that we're asking your consideration for approval today. They include enrollment enforcement protocols, professional development and training of our faculty and staff and our plan therein, our assessment plan, both from a qualitative and quantitative perspective as it relates to the implementation of the policy, and perhaps even more importantly, as it relates to student success and closing achievement gaps. And then finally, a wrap up with the communication and marketing branding toolkit that we have developed as a system. Next slide, please. First, a note on enrollment enforcement, and you'll see this noted pretty much in detail within the action plan itself. But what we're trying to do here is acknowledge that it's one thing to have a policy, it's another completely more important thing perhaps to make sure the policy is actually being followed. And of course, the intent of this policy, as you know, is to ensure that students are enrolling in their Gateway math and English course with or without support in the terms of COREC. And we want them to do that within the first year. And so this obviously needs to happen with informed decision-making by the student, and this experience between the student and our matriculation operations at each of our institutions through advising and communication is incredibly important, and that begins the enrollment enforcement protocols. Also important to note that they actually enroll in their math and English course with or without support. And then finally, that we monitor the student through completion of Gateway Math and English. And as we know, when we first started having these conversations many, seems like decades ago, but just a couple of years ago, we were talking about the importance that completion of Gateway Math and English has in ultimate college completion and ultimate retention therein. So we're really looking at this enrollment enforcement perspective from those three lenses. Talk some more specifically about that now. Next slide, please. So what we've asked each of the seven teaching institutions who are implementing this co-requisite plan to scale to do is to identify in writing what their plans are, what their nuanced plans are for ensuring enrollment enforcement. And you will see as you read through the action plan that advising is such a critical component of ensuring that students are informed, making informed decisions in some cases, and certainly enrolling in these courses. So many of the institutional plans include a significant proactive advising component. Other institutions are doing advising in addition to enrollment holds, meaning a student cannot enroll in their full plethora of courses until they have indeed registered for their Gateway Math and English course. And other institutions are doing those things and enrolling the students manually, particularly for first-time entering students, and this is particularly happening at University of Nevada, Reno. And I think that that is a solid move. However, given the scale and scope of some of our institution sizes, manual enrollment is a challenging component based on human resources. And so we're happy to see UNR doing this, and the other institutions are watching that work closely. There are some technical enforcement protocols within PeopleSoft that all seven of our institutional registrar's offices are engaging in and investigating right now. Basically to use the nuanced tools of PeopleSoft to not only promote enrollment, but to ensure that they enroll and stay enrolled. So those solutions are being developed now. Many thanks to our friends at UNLV, the technical team there who have developed a mod within PeopleSoft that the other institutions are currently exploring and testing. And then finally, as you know, communication is so critical to ensure that, A, advising occurred, B, the students enrolled, and C, they stay enrolled. And so the institutions, many of the institutions will be engaging in enrollment audits so that they can monitor whether or not a student ended up staying enrolled, if they're having any trouble with completion after perhaps semester one, that they communicate with the student it's time to re-enroll if indeed they had their withdrawal by time semester two rolls around, again, to ensure completion of Gateway Math and English with support or without within the first year. Next slide, please. Next, we're talking about professional development and training. And one of the things that we've been touting a lot with your support is that this has been this incredibly collaborative effort, not only in and across the state and the system, but also nationally. And as you know, in our conversations with you over the last couple of years, we have relied heavily on our national thought partners at Complete College America, at Student Ready Strategies, at the Dana Center, with our colleagues in California from the California Acceleration Project, and other states who have adopted full-scale statewide policy to support co-requisite implementation and remediation reform, essentially. As you also know, we're thankful for ECMC Foundation and Strong Start to Finish for their generous grants to support our institutions in these implementation efforts. And it was through these grants that we were able to build and provide a very robust professional and development training series for our English faculty across the system, our math faculty across the system, and our advising and student support staff across the system. We have also contracted with Complete College America and Student Ready Strategies to serve as an intermediary, a logistics coordinator, and to help us identify the right content experts to provide this professional development training. And all of these resources have been funded through the generous, again, support of these grants from ECMC and Strong Start to Finish. I want to give you a quick overview of what some of this PD looks like, so if we can go to the next slide, please. This is a snapshot, very brief snapshot, of what our math faculty are currently engaged in terms of their training in these now virtual webinars. They've already experienced in November a webinar around co-requisite math pedagogy and methodologies of Gateway Math placement. They're gearing up in February to learn from each other. As you know, our INSHE institutions have many of them, in fact, all of them at this point, are engaged in pilots for this work. And so they will come together in February and share their assessment results of those pilots and really learn from each other, both from the pilot outcome experience as well as, you know, how to plan for that curriculum just-in-time support that the co-requisite aims to do. In March, they'll learn about active learning techniques in math and online instruction for the co-requisite course, perhaps most importantly now more than ever, given the current situation with the pandemic. And then in April, they'll round out the academic year this year with training on growth mindset and effective learning and also assessment of co-requisite math for student outcomes. Next slide, please. We'll share with you just a brief overview of English and the engagement they've been having. Again, much like math in November, the English faculty have been engaged in English pedagogical professional development as it relates to co-requisite implementation. Coming up here in about another week, they'll engage in a webinar on English placement methodologies. February, they'll learn about reading strategies embedded in co-rec English and online instruction for the co-rec English course. And then they'll get into assessment like math in March. They're going to focus on access for students with disabilities as it relates to the co-rec experience, particularly as it relates to composition. And then in April, they'll round out their academic year for training around anti-racist teaching of writing and equity and contract grading with embedded student support. So as you can see, both the math and English faculty are not engaging in this implementation training and effort from a sort of one and done scenario, from a one day webinar and then they're hitting the ground running, but we're really dedicating our grant resources in a great regard to support their training. And finally, this next slide here, please, speaks to the advising professional development. As I've alluded to many times now throughout the presentations over the last year or so, we have such a significant reliance on the communication and the relational building that occurs between students and advising, not only at the front door of matriculation, but certainly throughout the entire student experience. And so with that, we wanted to dedicate a significant amount of time in planning and with our advisors across the system so that every one of our advisors who are on the ground doing this work truly understand not just what our implementation action plan is for co-requisite math and English, but really understand the why, the how, the messaging to students, the importance of student success, and how that messaging goes. So they'll, in fact, coming up on December 11th, a week from this Friday, they'll get about a three-hour session giving them an overview of our implementation action plan so far. We hope to give them that overview of both part one and part two, pending your action today. And then we want to provide lessons learned from INSEE advisors so far. These are advisors who have been advising in this space through the pilot projects over the last year or so. In January and in February, we'll talk placement into CORAC and Gateway courses and enrollment enforcement protocols. These will be hosted by each of the institutions because those nuances around placement and enrollment enforcement are indeed institutional specific. In March, they'll come together and talk about equitable advising students in Gateway and CORAC-quisite courses, and also advising the whole student with a focus on GRIT and Gateway success. April, they'll round out their PD series around specifically what did co-requisite math courses look like, and the same for English. We'll be inviting math and English faculty from across the system to present on each of those occasions. Next slide, please. A little bit about our assessment plan. We want to ensure two major things occur with our assessment. Number one, we want to make sure that the policy is being enforced with its full fidelity and make sure that all the nuances of the policy are working out in terms of implementation. Number two, we want to make sure that the outcome of this implementation is truly moving the needle on student success as was intended and closing the achievement gap as was intended. And so we have contracted with one of the foremost national experts through the generous support of one of our grantors to bring in the services of Dr. Bruce Vandal, Bruce Vandal Consulting. You may remember Dr. Vandal as he came to present to the ARSA committee well over, nearly 2 years ago now. We were first talking about the need for remediation reform. So he and INSEE system staff, along with significant representation and feedback from the INSEE CORAC Implementation Task Force, developed an assessment plan. It is, to steal a phrase from Vice Chancellor Raba, a mile wide and a mile deep. This assessment plan is probably the Cadillac of all assessment plans as it relates to assessing co-requisite implementation to scale. And I'm really proud of that because as we began this work in developing this, what is 13-page assessment plan, we went out there across the country and solicited other states, states like Georgia and Tennessee and California and Texas, states who have done this work with full scale. And what we found was sort of some good work out there for sure and some great research empirical assessment work out there, but nothing to the effect of full state assessment of a statewide policy with comprehensive metrics. And so that was one of the reasons we wanted to bring Bruce in on this, because he has consulted with so many of these states in developing nuances of their individual plans that we wanted to pull it all together and make sure it was contextualized appropriately for INSEE and for our institutions. And so within the action plan itself, in the appendix, you will see the full 13 or so page assessment plan there with all the metrics, the cohort that will be established, the timelines for that assessment, et cetera. It's important to also note that this assessment plan is very ambitious, and we knew that going into that. We also knew that this assessment plan is going to require additional resources by the institutions and the system office itself to actually carry forward. So we're obviously going to continue to look for those grant resources to help support this effort. But it's also important to note that the assessment plan was modularized. And so it's sort of a menu, if you will. We can prioritize the major important things that are important for us to begin assessing as early as fall 2022, 1 year after implementation. And then we can continue to build upon that by selecting from this menu of metrics and methodologies as more resources present themselves and become available. Next slide, please. We've been talking a lot about the development of this amazing co-requisite communication toolkit. This ensures, as you recall from part one, the consistent branding, the consistent messaging, and the significant focus on student success with this project. And so here is some snapshots from our friends at Great Basin College. A big shout out to Jennifer Sprout and Morgan Kaiserschott, who have led the communication team at GBC and have been leading this work for on behalf of the task force and the system. So these are some snapshots of some of the collateral. You'll note that in the PowerPoint and within the action plan, there is a link there at the top, more samples here, and you will see a variety of samples that are in that that communication toolkit. The intention here is what we're doing is giving all of the institutions, communication and marketing teams, communication templates that have been approved. With the right professional design, the right branding, the right logos, the right color schemes, et cetera. But we're also giving the institutions the opportunity, of course, to make them their own. You will see in the toolkit that each of the collateral items, this one you're seeing on the screen here on the left, is branded for UNLV. That same exact poster is branded for CSN and GBC and Western and Nevada and UNR, et cetera. And so each of the institutions should be able to plug and play as appropriate. So again, many thanks to GBC for their significant collaborative efforts in designing these collateral pieces. We're in the process now of launching a website, an external facing website, where all of these items, along with recordings of all of our professional development experiences, will be shared and easily accessible. Next slide, please. So as we recall from the September presentation, we heard, Chair Geddes, directly from you, an observation that we needed to focus very significantly as a task force and as a system on common gateway math pathways for business and health sciences as it relates to this CODEC work. And we have been doing that engagement with great fervor over the last several months. And what we've noticed and identified is we've got some discipline course specific reviews to do. And so through the direction of Vice Chancellor Abba, a task force or a committee, a short-term committee made up of representatives from each of the math departments at each of the institutions, will come together here shortly to talk about Math 120, Math 124, and Math 126. A discipline review following the traditional discipline review course review processes as a system. And we're looking and comparing the outcomes of each of those three courses to then hand over a process where we can truly understand what the most appropriate pathway will be for business and health sciences. We also acknowledge that we received the reinforcement from Chancellor Rose, reinforcing the need for this commonality, again, to assure optimal student transfer for students who are in these two particular pathways. And so we ask today that you grant us a little bit more time to engage in this deep dive around the discipline course review process, and ultimately then the recommendations for the Gateway Math course pathways in this regard. Next slide, please. And then finally, a brief note on our human and fiscal resource analysis. The system office, in conjunction with each of the representatives from each of the seven teaching institutions, spent well over 2 months working through nuances associated with the methodology to determine if there is indeed a fiscal gap in being able to bring this co-requisite implementation to full scale by fall 2021. And as the economic situation has unfolded and changed almost daily since this work began, we are asking for some more time to continue to conduct this analysis, most importantly, to ensure that we have consistent institutional methodologies in that analysis. Next slide, please. So with that, Chair Geddes, I bring this part two of two, co-requisite implementation action plan to you and the ARSA committee for consideration of approval. And following that, of course, any questions you have, I'm happy to take. And then I'd like to also yield any remaining time to Vice Chancellor Rava.
Thank you, James. Crystal, anything to add?
Very quickly, I just wanted to indicate my incredible gratitude to James. As you know, we've had several setbacks during this process since the policy was originally adopted in a year and a half ago. And we started out with the consultants. We realized very quickly that we needed dedicated resources at the system level to support the work of the task force. And in doing so, we went out and sought financial support from Strong Start to Finish and ECMC. That support allowed us to hire James in the position of Assistant Vice Chancellor and Director of Co-Requisite Implementation. While our original plan was for him to be with us in supporting this work through FY22, DSN is very fortunate in that he applied for the interim BPAA position and will be returning to DSN. Actually, he's back there now as of the 1st of December. However, his timing could not have been better because we have now delivered to the board the most significant piece of the work that was mandated to the implementation task force, which is this action plan. So from here on out, you won't have regular reports on COREC until we get through the first fall, which, as you know, full-scale implementation. We are set according to the action plan to do so as requested by the board in fall of 21. We will be taking some of those grant dollars that would have otherwise been allocated to the position and now utilizing it for the assessment plan. Because as James indicated, that plan is truly a gold standard. And there was a lot of language in the action plan that basically said how deep we dive into the assessment would be dictated by the resources available. And the irony of losing James is that now we'll be able to hire someone to support that type of work. We will continue. We are not disbanding the task force. We will continue to support the task force at the system level. Theo and I will step in to James's role and supporting the continuation of those professional development efforts that will go through April of 21. All of those professional development efforts, as James indicated, will be archived on our website. We're in the process of developing that PRO-REC website now. And of course, the big piece, as I know the chairman is acutely aware because we have these discussions on a regular basis, is establishing those common gateway math requirements for business and health science pathways.
And thank you very much, James. We would not be here today without your efforts and your enthusiasm, and you are like a cup of coffee in the morning, so I like hearing you present. And congratulations on your new role. Do I have a motion for approval of part two of the co-requisite action plan?
So moved.
Motion from Regent Trachok, second.
I'll second. Regent McAdoo.
Regent McAdoo. Any questions or comments on it?
Mr. Chair.
Regent Perkins.
I was just wondering how the COVID budgeting is going to affect the implementation, and has that been considered?
Vice Chancellor Abba.
From the standpoint of the work of the task force, we actually had that discussion back in March, and we adopted the motto of stay the course, because if we didn't stay the course, we were concerned that we would lose that support from Strong Start to Finish and ECMC. And remember, those dollars have been allocated to the institutions to support their efforts, particularly in the area of professional development and getting faculty prepared for full scale in fall 21. That said, we are going into a legislative session. It is unclear the extent to which, we know we're at 12% in terms of the cuts now. It is entirely possible that this will have an impact on the capacity, not on actual implementation of the policy, because the action plan covers that. But there may be some capacity issues there if cuts are so deep where critical faculty in these areas are released. But right now, our motto is stay the course.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you, and James said it feels like years, and I will say it has been years. We've been talking about, as I mentioned before, transfer, articulation, remediation. I've been talking about it since 1988, so it's been decades for me. And this is just some of the great progress that we've made recently, and really appreciate the efforts of James and Crystal and the team and the task force and all the institutions getting us to where we are. I do want to be clear, as I mentioned in September, I want to note it again that while the CO-REC task force was successful in establishing the Common Gateway Math requirements for STEM and liberal arts, as James alluded to, there's still work to be done in establishing the Common Gateway Math requirements for business and health sciences. They have more time to work on that. I want to be clear that the expectation of this committee and the board is that the Common Gateway Math requirement can be established to support that seamless transfer and student success. And I know James is in a new role, but he'll still be helping out, and Crystal and the task force will make sure that we get this to conclusion, because I think this will be a great step for all of us. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Regent Carter.
I just had a quick question. So the advising holds, when will those start?
James?
Yeah. Thank you, Regent Geddes. To Regent Carter, the fall 2021 registration cycle is just about ready to get started here in a couple of months. And so for those institutions who are using advising holds, specific enrollment holds, those will start in time for registration cycles to begin.
Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, seeing none, all in favor of approval of part two of the co-requisite action plan, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you again, James, and good luck.
Thank you.
We will now go to item number 12, ACT, Nevada High School Class of 2020 Profile Report, and Nishi College Readiness Dashboard. Crystal.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. Continuing the trend on this agenda, this is a two-part presentation, so we'll start with Bruce Smith, who is the ACT Director of Statewide Partnerships. He is presenting the class of the high school graduating class of 2020 ACT results. Many of these students took this test in their junior year. Some of them took it again in their senior year. But Bruce is going to lay the groundwork in terms of what that looked like for the state of Nevada. And then I will follow with a quick demonstration on a new data dashboard that was developed for your use that is now on our website that utilizes ACT data from our statewide longitudinal data system. So with that, Bruce, I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you. I've been introduced. I'm Bruce Smith with ACT, and we've got our topic at hand, so if you'd move to the next slide, please. So this is just a high-level view of our game plan for the few minutes we have today to review this. So we want to talk about Nevada's information as far as the data coming back from the grad class, compare that a little bit to what we're seeing nationally, and then also then review equity and access as far as opportunities for growth there, what their post-secondary plans are, and then any conversation or guidance that you have for ACT, if you can move to the next slide, please. All right, I won't reintroduce myself. We'll go here. I'll let you read these nine panels, if you would. Well, I'm happy to report this meeting pretty much follows what this cartoon is showing as I've been monitoring. This has become our new normal. We would obviously much prefer to be there with you in person. I know you'd much prefer to be meeting in person as well, but this is what we're dealing with. You can go to the next slide, please. But our teachers have a different reality. And so I've got a daughter who's a third grade teacher, and she actually sent me a Snapchat of what would be in that top panel. And it was her face with her eyes rolled, and in the background, the carnage that has become remote teaching for a lot of our teachers. And then my high school colleagues basically expressed the one on the bottom, which is the challenge of getting students in a remote environment to even engage with them. So we're living in different times, but we'll get through it. And if you go to the next slide, please. So, as Crystal described, when we talk about the graduating class data, I just want to be specific here. The majority of it in Nevada is going to be students who took their test their junior year. But what we collect is actually the last instance of that of a student. So there will be some student data in there that could be somebody who took it their sophomore year, and then they didn't take it again because maybe they moved out of state. But we still have them listed as a student who took the test in Nevada. There will be a larger number, though, who would have taken it a second time as a senior, though this year that's been particularly challenging because of COVID. But it's the students who have indicated to us that they will be graduating, that they would have graduated in May of 2020. Next slide, please. So a high-level snapshot across the country is, if you look at the states that are in blue and in green, The states that are in blue are like Nevada, which are the states that are funding the ACT for all their juniors. The vast majority of them use it in their accountability program. The ones that you see in green are states where they allow districts to choose between the SAT and the ACT. And so we have varying levels of participation in those. Like if I go to Oklahoma, which is another state that I work with, about 95% of the students take the ACT in Oklahoma, even though it shows as a choice state. In Nevada, of course, it's 100% of the juniors are taking the ACT. Next slide, please. So COVID's been a challenge, and it's been, you know, we're zooming into this meeting or blue genieing into this meeting. And ACT and College Board as well, but ACT has had the exact opposite problem that the airlines have had, which is the airlines have got lots of planes and lots of seats and nobody wants to go anywhere. We have the exact opposite problem, which is you've got students who want to move on with their educational lives, but very little opportunity to sit and take the test. Thankfully, and just, you know, by pure luck, Nevada took the ACT in the early window in the spring before the COVID shutdown hit everyone. So Nevada is one of the few states in the country that was very much not impacted in the early test windows for COVID. But to give you an idea of what it has created is in both June and July, we had about 350,000 students for each of those test events who wanted the test. So 350,000 students wanted to. We only had about 60,000 seats for them. And so we have a lot of parents and students, parents who have had this kid in their house for 18 years and they're ready for them to move on. But because we use school buildings to test, it just became a giant problem for us. And while we plan for hurricanes, we plan for tornadoes and floods and flu breakouts in school buildings, we've never planned for a global pandemic. So it's been particularly challenging. Next slide, please. So I'm going to come back to this because this is an area of growth for us that we see for Nevada as an organization. And this is not unlike what we see nationally. So the first thing we ask students to do is provide us some information about what courses are they taking and what grades do they expect to get. We want to find out some general profile information that includes gender and ethnicity and an estimation of family income and those kinds of things. And then we also try to gather information about just what interests them as far as in their future. And we have a low participation rate in that in Nevada. It's very typical, I hate to say it that way, of when a state is giving the assessment, funding it, which is fantastic, people make the assumption that that information is already on record somewhere. But we see the opposite trend when people show up on a Saturday morning and they pull the $50 out of their pocket and pay for it, they fill out all that information. Now, we get caught, I'll tell you, we've been caught in a wide net that's cast to protect student confidentiality, in that people say you can't submit any of this information, we want to protect this from students. The problem it creates is it hurts our research efforts, but more importantly is it hurts the efforts of the universities and the scholarship granting organizations to do recruiting and outreach to the students, because they have a limited amount of information to work from. And so one of the things we're doing to try to correct for that is moving this information online so they can do it ahead of time. They don't have to do it the day of the test. And we think that'll help, because then they can do it as much as they want, when they want, over a period of time and collect that information. Next slide, please. So this is a busy slide, and there's a lot of numbers here, and you'll have access to these slides to take a look at. But what I want you to focus on is the top row, where it shows that 1.67 million students took the ACT as a graduating class member nationally. About half of those take them as a state assessment program like Nevada does. And then, so that's a big number, and we expect that will continue to stay stable or grow. And then if you look at the box in the lower right side, this shows the score trends for Nevada. And so we'll take a look at those a little bit more in depth, but Nevada is trending higher. Overall, you'll see that our national average has been trending lower by about 0.1 per year. So meeting with Nevada, this is a more enjoyable meeting to have than in other states sometimes when they're moving the other direction. But we'll get into some of that. Next slide, please. So this is Nevada's participation. And so you'll see that for a long time, it was between 5,000 and 10,000 students who were participating. And so this was students who were showing up on a Saturday morning to test. Nevada then adopted a census or statewide testing model that all juniors now have the opportunity to participate in the ACT. So from an access standpoint, Nevada's doing a fabulous job. The other thing that you'll see, though, is it is very, very typical when a state goes to a statewide model from a student choice model where they're showing up on a Saturday, the average composite score will take a large drop. And again, because you're testing all students, not just the ones who plan to go to college. Next slide, please. And so this one, the lines look somewhat parallel, but what I tell you is they're not really parallel. And this is kind of what we see as far as trends go. And so while Nevada is below the national average, Nevada tests 100% of their students. And so that is to be expected. The good news for Nevada, though, is the scores are trending slightly higher when our national trend that we're seeing is trending slightly lower. So the goal now is that, and we're working with Superintendent Ebert and her staff, is how can we help them support continuing this progress moving forward? Next slide, please. So here's one of the things we do, and with Vice Chancellor Ava, we talk about things that stand out as unique. And so the, one of the things we do when we look at this information, we go through a whole bunch of stuff, and we find stuff that jumps out as either this is tremendous news, this is painful news, or this is just interesting because it's different. One of the things that we found that was different was the difference in the score between a student who sits for the test once and then a student who sits for the test a second time. And the score point difference on the scale of 1 to 36 is 4.6 points, which is a lot when they go to test twice. Now, there's two things that we typically see that impact that. One is when you do a census or a statewide test, you use it for accountability. A lot of times, that's the first time students have seen this kind of content, and it's the first time they've ever had to manage their time when they take a test. And so that's part of it. And the other part that we see is that students who take it the second time are the more motivated students, or their parents are more motivated for them, and they have them show up on a Saturday to take a second time. I want to talk, we'll talk about this a little bit more, but one of the things we're trying to do that we wanted to study this year, and COVID threw a giant wrench in it, is in Douglas County and in Elko, we were doing a pre-ACT pilot with part of their student body, and the idea is we wanted to compare those two groups of students to see if the pre-ACT gives them access to the content, it gives them experience in a timed assessment. They would take it at grade 10, though. And then it gives them feedback as to the kinds of things they have strengths in and the kinds of things they want to improve in. COVID threw a giant wrench in it. They did participate in the pilot, and then everybody went home for the year. And so the teachers who wanted to engage them and who were all ready to take these reports and put them to work didn't get to do that. So we're going to try to do a do-over in the spring of 2021, and we're working on those plans right now. Next slide, please. And so this, again, is just a quick snapshot of what you see in that difference. On retesting Nevada, only about 17% of the students will take the assessment more than once. Nationally, we see that at 41%. We think there's some things we can do about that, and I'll review a little bit what Superintendent Ebert and her team are working on with us. Next slide, please. So when we look at that scale score, a lot of times people ask, and you may be familiar with this, they're like, what does that mean? What do the numbers mean on a scale, and why are they important? And if I boil it down to one quick example, we'll use the top line, English, that if you score, this is a national survey that ACT does, we track and follow students as they go into their university classes, and we track their success rate. And it's kind of a probability thing. So if you score an 18 on that subsection of the test or higher, you have a 50% chance or greater of getting a B in the course and a 75% chance or greater of getting a C in the course. So there's a direct correlation to success in college if you score at those points. And so that's why taking like the pre-ACT ahead of time and getting those targets in place is really important for students, because it results in success for them. And so in addition to this information, Vice Chancellor Abba and her team collects not only this information, but they've got a very robust set of data, longitudinal data that they've collected along these terms, where they're able to also then apply this in a more specific sense, because this is national information. They're able to apply it more specifically to Nevada students. Next slide, please. And so this is some five-year trends, and again, it's a lot of numbers on a page and a lot of numbers that can be hard to read. What I point out to you, the one area that we see that had the biggest growth is in a five-year period of time, English score has gone up by 0.5. That's a lot. And it goes, as you can see, the column right next to that, the national trend is trending lower. So Nevada's moving in the right direction there. But that's a bigger snapshot. And so if you go to the next slide, please. In a bigger picture, if we look at the average of all of them, the state has trended higher by 0.2 over a five-year period of time when they started giving it to all students. And the national snapshot is that nationally, the scores have gone down by 0.2. And so again, Nevada's in a good position from the standpoint of the trends, and we want to maintain that. We go to the next slide, please. And so this one is that self-reporting. And so only about half the students tell us this information. And we want to encourage the counselors in the high schools to encourage the students to fill this information in, because it is very valuable information. But what this tells us, what core or more it is that students have taken 4 or more years of English, 3 or more years of math, social studies, and science. And what our research demonstrates, as you can see here, is if you look at the box over on the lower right, is that students who in Nevada who take core or more score about 2.5 points higher than students who are taking less than core. And you've got to be ready to take, I mean, we know you've got to be ready to take those courses with the prerequisites and knowledge base. But exposure to more rigor helps students perform higher and opens many doors for them then from an educational standpoint. We go to the next slide, please. And this one is just, STEM is a little bit different, and I just want to explain why that number is significantly higher. So on that benchmark that we talked about where your chances of success in those freshman year courses, with STEM, the STEM is actually the average of the science and the math score. And the reason we do STEM separately is students who are going into medical and into engineering courses, they often don't start with algebra. They'll start with calculus or statistics or higher level courses. And because that level of rigor in those coursework and the coursework for science and math is higher for those degree fields, then we have a higher benchmark for those students to shoot for and to prepare for. Next slide, please. All right, I talked a little about reporting and how we can help from an access standpoint, students do better. One of the things that happens, and Nevada is no different than most states, is when they start giving it to every student, what happens is the waivers go way down. And the waiver for this means that if a student is on free or reduced lunch, they can take the ACT for free on a Saturday with the national testing date. In fact, if they get a waiver, they can take it 4 times. And what we want to do, though, is encourage people, and we're working with the Superintendent Ebert's team with this, which is to inform counselors to continue to request those waivers. Because even though the student's going to sit for that test on their junior year as part of the accountability program, we want them to gain access to the test additionally once they've had experience with that. The other thing they get is they get free test prep. And so we have digital, and this is the expensive one. If you've got kids that have taken this test, this is the one that you get out the credit card to pay for. But they have free access then to the test preparation. And so this is one of the things we want to encourage. The other thing that a waiver does is you can send unlimited score reports to both colleges and universities and scholarship organizations. So this is a really big advantage. There aren't very many students who are taking advantage of it right now, and we want to encourage that. So if we can go to the next slide, please. So this is, again, some numbers, but what I'd have you look at is the bold font at the bottom. Only about 4% of Nevada students are using waivers. And roughly 60% of students in Nevada qualify for free or reduced lunch. So actually 60% of the students could qualify for a waiver. And so this is why we see this as an area of, it's never easy growth, but it's an area, it's low hanging fruit for growth, let's put it that way. And so we want to really work with counselors and others to encourage them to apply for these waivers, and all they have to do is send in the paperwork that shows that Bruce Smith is on free or reduced lunch, and then I would receive those waivers and test tickets to go take the test, but we can work on that with them. Next slide, please. All right, so what are they telling us they're gonna do? So this is self-reporting, and again, you'll look at the bottom, no response. So still about half of them aren't telling us what they have planned. That's on the counselors to do a better job of encouraging them to do that. And to encourage them that just because you tell somebody what you want to do today doesn't mean you're locked into that tomorrow. But it tells us, as far as the breakdown, what they want to do as far as two-year college, bachelor degree, graduate programs, those kinds of things. And so one thing that I'm going to be curious about this next year is, will COVID impact that? Oftentimes when we see economic downturn, we see increases in enrollment in two-year and vocational programs. I'll be curious to see if we see that trend take place because of this pandemic. Next slide, please. So when they go to these schools, what do they want to study? And this has been very consistent. It's not surprising that the majority of the students, the 10%, still say that they want to go into the health sciences field. We see that that's pretty typical across the nation, very typical in Nevada. Again, this is where we want to work with the counselors too as well. If you look at that very bottom line, no response. So 50% of the students didn't tell us what they want to do when they get out of high school. we want to improve on that so it makes the life easier and better for your recruiting activities, for the scholarship organizations, and also just for our research as far as the information we collect. So the other thing, too, that you'll see the green line I put there, which is there's 584 students who have indicated that they have an interest in teaching. This is an ongoing challenge in that to recruit people to go into the teaching profession. It's about 2% nationally. It's about 3%. I think I saw somewhere that we need somewhere around 5% kind of in the funnel for teachers to replace the teachers who are either leaving teaching or retiring. And so, but this gives you a breakdown of the percentage of what people are interested in doing with their educational lives after they graduate from high school. So next slide, please. So where are they going to get this information, this next step in their educational life? You'll see the top four choices are all Nevada schools. The next one says Iowa, which is people who have said they have no college plans. Nevada does not send their students to Iowa. They have no college plans. That just happens to be where ACT is located, so it defaults in that way. And then you'll see that it spreads out to what you would expect your neighboring states for the next choices that, that students are making for their post-secondary education plans. Next slide, please. So what are your neighbors up to? And so let's take a look at some surrounding states as to how they utilize or don't utilize the ACT. Next slide. So Utah. Utah is very much like Nevada. When I say census, I probably should stop using that word because sometimes people use different terminology. This means that the state is funding it statewide for all juniors. And so Utah uses the ACT for that. It's funded. It's part of their accountability program, just like Nevada. So very, very similar model. Next slide. Arizona is just starting this process. I think this is year one for them, but they allow districts to choose either the ACT or the SAT. It is funded by the state. It is part of their accountability program, and all juniors will be taking the assessment. So it's like one, a couple of my other states, like Oklahoma, where they actually get to choose which test that the individual district wants to utilize. Next slide. California is complicated. They don't do funding as far as for students to take the assessment. Obviously, students can use waivers and those kinds of things. There's no state funding or direction on it. They moved earlier this year to go to a test optional or test blind model for the university system. And they their game plan is to build a test in the future that they will utilize as standardized tests for college entrance. So instead, California has, they have 14 different criteria that they use for college entrance requirements. And it's complicated. People don't really like it because they feel like they're gaming the system a little bit, but it's required courses. It's competitive by which major you tell a university that you're applying to that you expect to receive. That some still use standardized test scores, GPA, and other things like that. And so it's kind of complicated. Next slide, please. And so this kind of brings us to the end of it, which is, I put this little wavy arm guy, we've all seen that at the car wash or the car dealership, typically. We didn't spend a bunch of money on marketing it, and I'm glad we didn't now, because we have big plans for what we're going to do in September of 2020. We made those big plans in 2018 and 19 before COVID hit. And so most of it revolved around online testing. Online testing for national Saturday test day, section retesting. So you can just take just the math section again if you want, rather than sit for the whole test. It has to be done in an online environment. Rapid score reporting was to get scores back to students within 48 hours. Super scoring will continue because we can do that independent of that. I expect we'll roll that out in either this month or in January, but it's coming out. It's just a complicated process of merging files for students who have taken the ACT multiple times over different periods of years. And the other one we're working on is remote proctoring. We've talked about remote proctoring for a number of years. There really wasn't a driving demand for people to move forward with it. But with COVID, now all of a sudden, people want to do more remote proctoring. So this threw a wrench in things. But if I was to sum it up for Nevada, I would say Pre-ACT was sidelined as far as a pilot. We think there are great advantages to doing that, and we plan to do a do-over in spring of 2021. Retesting with waivers for senior retesting, we think, is also a real area of growth for us because of the other benefits it brings. And as of yesterday, talking with the department, the game plan is still that they plan to test students this spring. And so that kind of brings me to the end. And so I'd ask you, if you have guidance or feedback for us, I want to take advantage of that while I have you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any comments or questions from the regents? Regent McAdoo?
Thank you. I cannot help but wonder how ACT would be able to assist, let's just say, with helping to increase the waiver students retaking the test. And also, I'm very curious about in the ACT contract with the state of Nevada, how your, I'll call your company, how do you go about working with the counselors, especially, and even the teachers, to analyze the data and really be able to assist the students in choosing or even changing classes their senior year to help them prepare for college readiness?
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
The answer to the first two basically is that we work directly with counselors through, well, now it's webinars, but we would do face-to-face workshops with them, and they were kind of more all-encompassing. So on the workshops, we not only wanted to cover with them, honestly, it's the blocking and tackling aspect. It's how do you receive the materials? How do you order the materials? How do you keep them secure? Those kinds of things. But we quickly dive into information related to getting students waivers and reminding them of the importance of it. And it's incumbent upon us as an organization and the Department of Education as we schedule these to make sure that that's an important item in the agenda that we continue to follow up on. So we want to encourage that. As far as the utilizing of the reports, we do workshops on a regular basis. Some of them, we call them College and Career Readiness workshops. And these are workshops that we are doing virtually this year, but we do them in person previously. And with Dr. Jonathan Moore at the department, one of the things that he asked us to do was to change those from being more global to being more specific to how do you utilize these reports in your classroom. Now, we get a subset from all the different districts who attend those meetings, and we want to, they're no charge. We want people to show up as much as possible. I guess some ways, this is where COVID changes the game, because we didn't used to do these virtually. We did them in person. And so doing these virtually, then they become open to everybody. They become recorded sessions. And I think that we'll see how that works, because it's the first time we've been doing these. And so, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We'll see what happens. But I think it'll be an opportunity for us to allow our people who work typically in the buildings with them to talk to more teachers who oftentimes, you know, the message gets lost. You know, you district sends somebody, they go back, they tell the counselors tell, it's like that game you play in your classroom where you share the secret and by the time it comes back around, it's completely different. COVID probably forced us into an environment that will benefit everybody down the road, I think, because of bringing the message and having it recorded for teachers to utilize. So, but those are, we can do what we can do. We're always happy when they invite us in to help with that, but we would ask that people encourage that.
May I ask a follow-up question, Chair Gettys?
Yes.
Thank you. So how often are you providing those? I would call them, it sounds like professional development trainings. How often are those provided? Or are they only provided when a school district in Nevada requests it? And let's just say that Washoe County School District requested it. Would that training, especially virtually, then be offered to all school districts in the state? Is that advertised out to all the districts? Thank you.
We have an advertisement out to all the districts when we do these on, where they're very specific about, like, score report usage, or sometimes we will get as granular as utilizing your math results, that kind of information. Yeah, we do those. And one of the things that we've also done, and it's kind of I'll admit it's tailing off. It was much stronger earlier in the fall. And some of it is just that we're in December now, is we were doing virtual office hours every Friday. And so a couple of my colleagues would just, we would open up a meeting just like this and allow anybody, we'd advertise, and anybody in the state can join, ask any questions they want. And the questions, as you can imagine, are very wide ranging. But we try to do just as an office hours. And it's been very popular, but it is fading off now, which we kind of expect once people, you know, kind of get into the full school year.
I would like to encourage you to recharge the batteries for that.
Okay.
So thank you.
Yep, we will do so.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We're going to wrap it up here, but our staff and our institutions will continue to work with you and your organization and with the Nevada Department of Education on how we can improve this testing and improve the results and close the cycle, make sure we're getting more students tested and more students remediated and more students college ready. Crystal?
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Regents.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abbott, if SCS will pull up my slides, I know that we're out of time. I've made a commitment to CFO Klinger and 5 minutes, so bear with me. First slide, please. Next slide. The purpose of this presentation is to basically show you a demo of the college readiness dashboard that we created. All of the data that we're using here is accessed thanks to the creation of the statewide longitudinal data system, NPower. So basically the report that Mr. Smith just presented to you is for the entire high school graduating class. We then take that data, put it into our system, and show what that looks like for those students that are then enrolling in an NSHE institution. The hyperlink that's here, you can use to follow me if you want, or I'm showing you snapshots. I am happy because I'm going through this so quickly. If anyone would like me to meet with them individually, and that includes members of the public, students, faculty, or regents who would like me to take you through this one-on-one, I'd be happy to do so. Next slide. The reason we created this dashboard was there was a period in time when we were using placement data across the institutions to gauge whether or not students were prepared for the rigors of college level coursework. And to make a long story very, very short, over time, that data became problematic as we realized that there were inconsistent methods in terms of the placement use of that data as we started to use multiple measures and guided self-placement. Not all institutions were using the same methodology, so we lost the ability to really compare across institutions. And that's the beauty of ACT. Not only is it administered by an independent third party, but it's administered statewide. So all of this data is with respect to Nevada high school graduates only, and specifically those Nevada high school graduates that enroll in one of our NSHE institutions. Next slide. So what really makes this data powerful is that we are looking at college readiness relative to what the student did in high school. And the data that we use to gauge that is based on diploma types. So there are two primary diploma types, the standard diploma, which is 22 and a half credits, and the advanced diploma, which is 24. The difference between the two diplomas is an additional year in social studies. And the real important piece to this is the additional year in mathematics and then, of course, science. Next slide, please. With the class of 2018, NDE added what they refer to as the college-ready and career-ready diploma. And there actually should be a correction to this slide where it says college-ready diploma there in the column, but it should be college and career-ready. In order to receive a college or career-ready endorsement, you have to meet the course requirements for the advanced diploma, be proficient in speaking two or more languages, or take at least 2 units of AP, IB, dual credit, workplace learning courses, or a world language course. Then in addition to that, in order to show that you have proficiency at a college level, you have to achieve the associated college or career ready endorsement. Now for the college ready endorsement, slide 15 that Bruce just showed you, which is the college readiness benchmark by ACT, that's what this board adopted for the purpose of placement into a college level course. So NBE, when they originally made the decision to go with the ACT, they partnered with NSHE, and they agreed that they would follow that endorsement for the purpose of making sure that students are aware when they meet with their counselor that in order to be considered ready for college and avoid at that time remediation, you would have to achieve those scores, for example, a 22 in math and an 18 in English. Next slide, please. So on to the functionality of the dashboard. If you click on that link, there are five basic tabs. A tab that describes a lot of definitions. It gives information on the diploma types. It gives information on the ACT benchmarks. Then we start out at the high level of the funnel where we look at all high school graduates. It funnels down to then looking at those graduates that enroll in our institutions. And all of these are then broken out by ACT, SAT score, diploma type, and race and ethnicity. And you'll see the last two tabs there is where we take the deeper dive into average ACT score, also by district and charter school, and then average ACT score depending on where students are enrolling. Next slide, please. I'm not going to go into great detail on the functionality here, but the one piece that I want to point out is the tooltip. In all of these tabs, as you look at the graph that's presented on the website, you can hover over any individual column in the graph, and that tooltip will give you the actual numbers that were used in deriving the percentages. So if you're utilizing this data for research, it gives you a level of information that wouldn't otherwise be visible. Next slide, please. So if we look at the second tab of the data dashboard, these are all Nevada high school graduates by diploma type. So if you look at the class of 2018, and this is the most recent data that we can access through the statewide longitudinal data system, the 19 data will be available later this year. So we'll have that up and running sometime in January or February. But for the class of 18, those that received a standard or advanced diploma, it was almost 30,000 students, 29,000 students. And you can see that the vast majority of students in Nevada graduate with a standard and not an advanced diploma. And the unfortunate takeaway from all of this data is that those students who graduate with a standard diploma are far less likely to be prepared for the rigors of college level coursework. So if you're inside of the data dashboard and you clicked on the column that is marked 17-18, next slide, please, it would then take that 29,000 students and disperse it by diploma type by school district. So for example, you can see for Clark County, and you can hover over Clark County and see that there were 21,292 graduates for Clark County, of which 72.5% received a standard diploma and 27.5% received an advanced diploma. Next slide, please. So this moves on to the third tab. The third tab is the capture rate. So of those 29, next slide, please. Of those 29,000 high school graduates in the class of 18, we enrolled at an NSHE institution within 1 year of high school graduation, 42.6% of those students, or 12,634. Now you can see over time that that capture rate in terms of the percentage is relatively stable, especially in the last 2 years, right around 42.5%, but the number is going up because the class size each year graduating is increasing. If you clicked inside the dashboard on that green column there for the 17-18 data, next slide please, it would then break out that 12,634 students by the institutions that they are enrolling within our system. So you see if you added up all those numbers there, it would equal the 12,634 is the NSHE total, and you can see where most of them are enrolling, which is at CSN. And you can also see the trend from this that students with a standard diploma are more likely to enroll in a community college than a four-year institution. So for example, look at UNR. 81% of the students that they are capturing enrolled with an advanced diploma. Next slide, please. So if you clicked on any one of those columns, and this is the statewide amount where, again, we break it out by race and ethnicity. So you could click on the UNR bar, you could click on the UNLV bar, and then look at the breakdown by race and ethnicity and the percent of students that received the standard or advanced diploma. Next slide, please. Now I'm on tab four. Tab four of the dashboard is labeled average ACT score. And from this, you can see at the top, you can pull down statewide totals by school district or charter school, and then you can select the subject test. This one is the statewide scores in ACT English. Now, the takeaway here, the English ACT score benchmark, which is what students must achieve in order to avoid remediation or going forward a co-requisite course where they could enroll directly into the college level gateway course, is 18. Students in our state who enrolled in ENCHI with an advanced diploma on average had a score of 21.6. So you can see they're above the ACT benchmark, so clearly ready for the rigors of college level coursework in English, and above the national average, which is 20.2. Now, the unfortunate takeaway here is those students with the standard diploma do not achieve the college readiness benchmark score of 18, where their average is 16.7, and they are considerably far off from the national average of 20.2. Next slide, please. I will skip this slide because this is the same version of the prior slide, but for math. Next slide, please. This is also for the science, so we'll skip this as well. And this is the composite score. And you'll notice the composite score because the composite is basically an average of all the subject matter tests. There's no actual benchmark for the composite, but you can see the comparison there is for the national average. And again, the staggering takeaway is those students with an advanced diploma exceed the national average in terms of their composite score, where advanced standard diploma students, and again, it's because of that extra year of social studies, that extra year of math, and that extra year of science. It makes a considerable difference in terms of preparing students for the rigors of college level coursework. The last piece, next slide, please. Slide 8 should be on 18. Here we're taking Nevada high school graduates enrolling at ENCHI, and we're just looking generally at their average score. And so this is actually, you can do a drop-down box, same thing where you pick it by individual institution. In this particular slide, I have broken it out or selected from the drop box for your institution. So this is an aggregation of Nevada State, UNLV, and UNR. And you can see, again, it shows their average score. Now, if you, inside the dashboard, if you hovered over and clicked on the last column for the class of 18, next slide, please, it then breaks it down by race and ethnicity. So you can see there relative to the ACT national average, how well students do within their race and ethnic categories. Next slide, please. So this is the same breakdown from two slides ago, except for two-year institutions. And again, the functionality within the dashboard is you can select any institution and get this breakdown for a comparison. You can also select different subject matter areas. Next slide, please. And last slide, please. I apologize for my haste in this, and I also give my apologies to CFO Klinger and Trevor Hayes for edging into their committee time. Again, I am happy to answer any questions, but it may be more appropriate if you would like a deeper dive into this data that I meet with you individually and go over the functionality and some of the takeaways. Mr. Chairman, I apologize for going over.
That's all right. Thank you, Crystal. Any questions or comments? This is information only. I would encourage you to schedule time with Vice Chancellor Abbott and our team and take a deep dive. Very good data. All right, seeing none, we'll close that item. We'll go to item number 14, new business. Is there any new business? Hearing none, we'll go to item number 15, public comment. Winter, is there any public comment?
No public comment.
Thank you. With my apologies to CFO Klinger and to Chair Hayes, sorry we went over. We are adjourned.